Okay, everybody, let's begin. Welcome back to our mini-series live from the Biblical Museum of Natural History. My name is Natan Slifkin. I'm the founder and director of the museum. And today's topic is Tehillah. Now, Tehillah is something that question is not what to speak about, but rather what not to speak about. It's a topic that could go on forever in a million different directions, lots of literature. What I'd like to try and do, though, is focus on the big picture, as kind of a macro perspective, and not get too lost in minutiae of discussion. All right. Now, this today's class, it's going to require us being in one, two, three different halls of the museum. So we're going to be moving around a bit. I want to start off here. Right now, we are in our Serpentarium. I don't know if that chicken is bothering you. I'm not sure if you can hear him or not. But not really very much I can do about him. Okay. So here we are in our Serpentarium, focused around snakes, but we also have an exhibit behind me of insects of the Bible. And Tehillah is essentially about color, or how to or color which is applied to fabric. Right, color, which is applied to the strings of tzitzit, to the garments of the Kohen, and to the covering of the Mishkan, right, of the tabernacle. And so I'm just making sure that everyone can hear. One person that can't hear, but I think everyone else can hear. Yep, fine. Again, if you want to message me at any point, write in the chat box. I won't necessarily be able to reply immediately, but I should be seeing any messages that pop up in the chat box. Okay. Now, question is, how do you make fabric special? You might have a special, design. It might have a special texture to it. And another way to make fabric special is the color. Now, color is something which nowadays, we really take for granted, right? Wearing a blue shirt, simple blue collar worker, right? Now, nowadays we take it very much for granted that you can get clothing in any color you want. But in antiquity, it was not so easy. Wasn't so easy at all. How do you make something a different color? Now we talk about getting stained, right? You have a grape juice stain on your shirt. The truth is that when you have a grape juice stain in your shirt, it might not wash out completely, but it washes out pretty good. Right? It's the idea of having, you can't just, squeeze berries onto your clothing and then it'll be dyed whatever color you want from the berries, because it'll just come out. It'll just wash out. So having a color that will hold in the clothing, turns out that's not so easy at all. Not at all easy. And that's why, and the techniques which in antiquity that they did come across for dyeing clothing, right? Those techniques ended up, especially for the main colors that people were interested in, the reds and the blues and things like that. They did find techniques for doing it, but those techniques were extraordinarily expensive. Very, very difficult. So in general, if you were to, go back into antiquity and see people, the clothing they'd be wearing, right, would be very drably colored. Color was something expensive. And presumably, one of the reasons why it took on great significance in the Torah, right? We want to talk about fabric that has significance, that's going to be used, for purposes, with sanctity, anything special, something you want to notice and it'll make you think about something. So there's color. And I'm dwelling on this. It's something that people nowadays just take for granted. We don't think about it. But you have to realize that for most of history, color was something very, very special. Absolutely not at all to be taken for granted. And before talking about Tehillah, I want to talk about a different color, which is red. The color red. Where does the color red come from? Or where did it come from in antiquity? Actually, even today. Red was a hard color to find, and the solution that they came up with, the source that they found for red, was incredible. Red in the Torah is called Tolaat Shani, right? Tolaat Shani. And what I find very interesting is that even Torah scholars, when they talk about Tolaat Shani, it doesn't occur to them what that phrase really means with regard to the color. Right? What's Tolaat? Tolaat is, well, it's usually translated as a worm, right? But not necessarily what we would use the word for in contemporary English. It means like a bug, right? A bug. there was a red bug, and that's where the color red came from. Well, not necessarily that the bug itself was red, but that the color red came from a certain bug. And in fact, there's a verse in Tanakh, I forget where, it talks about Anashim Matula'im, like the bug guys. And what it's talking about, the bug guys, it's not talking about entomologists or exterminators. It's talking about soldiers, right, who were known by the color red, by the bright colors that they wore. Like nowadays, you know, we're used to soldiers dressing in camouflage clothing. But in ancient times, what the soldiers, instead of going for camouflage, what they wanted to do is, you know, strike fear in the hearts of their opponent. So wearing they'd wear dramatic colors, right, a red uniform. And because the red came from a bug, so the soldiers were called, you know, the bug guys. So what was the bug that red came from? So behind me, let's see if I can position the camera correctly. There we go. Okay, behind me is here at the museum, at the Biblical Museum of Natural History, we want to exhibit, you know, all the animals of the Bible. So the question, you know, how do you exhibit each animal? So, you know, with the lion, say, so we have a taxidermy model of a lion. We're not going to have a live lion in the museum. With a lot of the smaller animals, we have them as live examples. You know, the reptiles and so on, snakes, things like that. But when it comes to the invertebrates, the insects, so it's not always necessarily so practical, you know, to have live exhibits, you know, ants. Okay, so we have an ant colony here. Scorpions, we've got some live scorpions here. Some of them are not necessarily so practical to exhibit. We don't have any live bees. Leech, I refuse to have a live leech at the museum. They just give me the heebie-jeebies. All right, so what I came up with is these signs for all the insects that mentioned in Tanakh, right, even the ones that we do have live examples of, but just, you know, a big, bright picture of the creature together with the verses that mention it and a little bit of explanation. And Tolat Shani is, how do I do this? Tolat Shani is over here. Let me see if I can zoom in the camera. Oh, there we go. Right, this is Tolat Shani. Now, what you're seeing here is a magnification, an enormous magnification, of a pregnant female Tolat Shani, which has been partially cut open. That's what you're looking at. Right? And it's an insect called a kermes. Not kermit, kermes. And a kermes bug, it's a scale insect. That's what this type of insect is called. And there's actually a real one, not alive, but dead, a real one right here. I'm pointing at it with my finger. It's absolutely tiny. Just like a mustard seed or something, absolutely tiny. But this insect, when they're female or when they're gravid, right, when they're full of young, ready to reproduce, in insects it's not called pregnant, it's called a gravid. So the tiny babies inside them are bright red. Bright red, you see them here coming out. And therefore, when you grind it up, you get an amazing red dye. All right, so that is Tolat Shani. And obviously, you know, you need tremendous amounts of these insects in order to produce the dye. So again, that is why red dye was very, very expensive, very, very special thing. Red clothing, scarlet, right, was not easy to come by. These particular insects, let me zoom back out. These particular insects are found on certain trees, growing in certain trees in Israel. And they were harvested from the trees certain times of year, when the females are gravid. Eventually, they worked out there's a whole bunch of other insects that also produce the scarlet dye, and that were used even in modern times sometimes to produce it. I remember when I was growing up in England, so we had this candy called Smarties, which I think is the equivalent of M&Ms in the US or similar to that. And we knew you couldn't eat the red ones because the red ones were colored with Betelgeuse. Betelgeuse meaning this type of dye from an insect in this family. All right, so that's an example about how, you know, color was a very, very special thing. And the reason was that it came from a certain insect, which was very difficult to harvest in the large quantities necessary. But now let's move on to, so that was a red. Now let's move on to Tchelet, which is generally understood to be something blue or bluish. There's also Argaman, which is purple. One very important point I want to stress is that when we're talking about colors, so there's some mistaken assumptions people are make, which is that we always assume that, you know, the colors that we see are the colors that everyone sees. But it's not necessarily like that. There's a fascinating book, blanking on the title, showing that different cultures over history had completely different ways of relating to color, even of seeing color. It's something that's incredibly hard to wrap your minds around, but color, to a large extent, seems to be culturally determined. In other words, we would say, you know, there's red, there's purple, there's turquoise, you know, there's blue. The list of names of colors that we have are not at all necessarily the lists that exist in other cultures. And what we might see is two shades of a similar color, right? You have sky blue and you have navy, and they're both types of blue. So other cultures might see those as two completely different colors. It's really, really mind-bending, you know, to learn this. And you look at ancient texts, which describe, you know, the sea as being the same color as wine. How is the sea the same color as wine? But, you know, they had some different way of grasping color. Again, I'm not saying there was anything biologically different about how people function. I'm talking about culturally as a cultural effect on how people perceive color or the spectrum of color, what colors are similar, what colors are different. These seem to be culturally determined. It's an astonishing thing. So even though we talk about Tehelet as being blue or as being sky blue, right? It's not necessarily the case that that was limited to whatever we call blue or sky blue today. That may include other things that today we see as being different colors. Okay, moving on. So what do we know about Tehelet, about this color that was used again for tzitzit, for the garments of the Kohen and for the coverings of the Mishkan? So, the main thing we know from the Gemara is that it comes from a creature. It comes from a creature. It doesn't come from a plant or something else. It comes from a creature. And what is this creature? So this creature is something called a chilazon. Okay, a chilazon. And we are also told that this chilazon is something that lives in the sea. And over the last few years, there's been a lot of efforts to identify what this chilazon is. And what I'm going to endeavor to prove to you is that there is absolutely no doubt we know exactly what this creature is that was used for chilazon. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's the only thing that can be used for tehelet. It also doesn't necessarily mean that that's what we should use tehelet from that creature today. All right, so that gets into more complicated topics, which hopefully we'll have some time to discuss towards the end. But I'm going to show you how we know what this creature is, even though there's many people who will argue, will disagree. You know, when people ask me, you know, do we know what certain animal from the Torah is? So I always say, well, who do you mean we? You know, often there'll be people, yes, who know very clearly. It doesn't mean there's nobody who disagrees. There could be people who disagree. Right? The question is, are they disagreeing for good reasons or not for good reasons? All right. So what I'm going to do is show you how we know what this chilazon is. So first of all, I just want to read out to you the source from Menachot. Right, the source is, hold on a second. Okay, the Gemara Menachot says that the chilazon has the following characteristics. Its body resembles the sea. Its form resembles that of a fish. It emerges once in 70 years. You make tehelet with its dam, with its blood, and it's very expensive. All right, that's one set of clues we have in the Gemara. All right, again, its body resembles the sea. Its formation is similar to a fish. The tehelet comes from its blood. It emerges from the sea every 70 years, and it's very expensive, right? Then there's another clue, but before we can start dealing with those clues, I want to deal with something else first, another clue, which is that the Gemara elsewhere, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, speaks about Tchiyat HaMetim, right? The resurrection of the dead. How do we know there's such a thing as the resurrection of the dead? Or not how do we know, but how can we come to grasp such a thing? And we have to remember that the Gemara, the Talmud, was written at a time where people believed in spontaneous generation. which is, I don't know if you're familiar with that topic, it's one that got me in a little bit of trouble about 18 years ago. Basically, the standard belief in the ancient world was that there are certain animals that are not born from other animals, but they are spontaneously generated from dirt, from fire, from dust, from all kinds of different things, from sweat, and so on. And it was widely believed that there's, you know, that these creatures generate that way. So when the Gemara is trying to teach us, you know, how it's, don't be shocked at the idea of Tchiyat HaMetim, the resurrection, it's not unthinkable. It gives an idea from nature about how creatures can seem to like spontaneously generate. And the example the Gemara gives is a chilazon. Right? Chilazon, you know, this same word that we're seeing here for tchelet. And what does the Gemara tell us about this chilazon that helps us understand the idea of resurrection? It says, because you can go to the hills, go out to the hills, and you know, they're kind of barren, you don't see any life, and it can be pouring with rain. And then after a rainfall, all of a sudden you see chilazonot, you see chilazon everywhere. So what creature do you see after a rainfall? So I have an enclosure of them right here. Sorry, I said before we'd earlier would be in three halls, actually we're going to be in four halls. Okay, let's take a look at what we have here. This is a very damp, humid enclosure. And can you see what it's full of? Let me get the camera a bit closer. There we go. Can you see that? It is full of snails. Lots and lots of snails. Right, and those snails and slugs, right, these are the creatures that emerge after there's been lots of rainfall. These are actually giant African snails, potentially invasive species. But we have them here in exhibit at the museum. And to be honest, I really think they're cute. What can I tell you? I think they're cute. They get very large. Okay. And you know, living here in Israel, that's what we know, that generally the climate is kind of dry. But after a rainfall, you'll see all the snails come out. So that's already an indication. And it's, I guess you could say, well, maybe it's something else. Maybe it's another type of creature. You know, you could say that. But certainly, so snails are something that come out a lot after the rains in the hills. But there's something more than that, right? More than that, it's that we also know that the chilazon is something, the chilazon that was used for tchelet is something that came from the sea, right? That's something that's very, very clear in the Gemara, and in Chazal. And they speak about how the tribe of Zebulun were very upset that their portion of land wasn't so agriculturally beneficial. But the compensation for it was, says that they had access to the sea, and therefore they had access to the chilazon to produce the very special tchelet. So what we know is that the chilazon is something that lives in the land and comes out after the rain. And it's also, there's another type of chilazon that lives in the sea. Right, so once you're seeing that, that already, you know, massively narrows down what the chilazon is. It's not going to be, you know, an amphibian, because amphibians don't live in the sea. Right, so already, if you're talking about something that's also a land, there's varieties that live on land, and also there's varieties that live in the sea, so that pretty much already, you know, narrows it down to something in the snail family. Or again, you know, one of the earliest efforts to identify the chilazon was the Radzin Rebbe. And he was under the impression that, you know, we know about, if we're thinking about, you know, bluish kinds of liquids that come from sea creatures. So one famous candidate for that is this guy behind me over here. Right, that is an octopus, right? This is a lovely octopus that my neighbor found washed up dead on the beach in Ashkelon. So we got it preserved. And as is known, many creatures in this family produce, you know, a blue cloud of ink in order to, you know, disguise themselves when they need to make a quick getaway. And so the Radzin Rebbe was convinced that it was the cuttlefish, and that it was a cuttlefish. It's a creature in the octopus squid family. He was actually, you know, he was misled because producing a blue dye from cuttlefish, you know, he had someone do it for him, but it turns out that cuttlefish was not even an active or even necessary ingredient. It's just the person who was making for him put some cuttlefish liquid in it, but that had nothing to do with producing the blue. You know, even though these creatures produce a blue cloud in the sea, but you can't make a dye from it. And the only way you can make a dye is by using things that are not actually cuttlefish. But the other point is that cuttlefish cannot be a chilazon because chilazon is a land animal, right? There's no land octopuses, right? There's no octopuses, you know, crawling about on land. And even though they can come out of the water, it's not certainly not something that lives on the land and that comes out in the hills after a rainfall. Right? So chilazon is definitely not anything in the octopus family. It has to be something in the snail family. Okay. Now, when we get to snails, so there's lots of interesting, you know, choices. Here in this cabinet here, we have lots of different things in the snail family. It's actually beautiful, stunningly, stunningly beautiful. It really bothers me that museum visitors don't spend long enough looking at our snail collection because it's fabulous. I just have to, I want to show you a few personal favorites. Look at that. Turban snail from South Africa. See how incredible those colors, those patterns are? Absolutely exquisite. I'm not sure if my friends the Ormonds are watching, who were here last week, but they helped us with some of our things on exhibit here. There's a scale here, we've got cowrie shells. Some of the snails have been polished, but cowrie shells are naturally, you know, exquisitely beautiful. We've got the cone snail, close up cone snails here. Look at that texture. Unbelievable. Looks like it's coming off a computer printer. But it's not. This is the natural design generated by the snail as it grows. Some snails can get really big. Right, here's a Triton snail. Very beautiful, very large, but not the biggest snail in the world. The biggest snail in the world would be... gosh, it's heavy. Here, the Australian trumpet snail. Right, up to, it goes up to 18 inches long, way up to about 18 pounds. Right, it's a giant Australian trumpet snail. What we have here, actually, I want to show you is this. This is an egg sac of an Australian giant trumpet snail that I managed to get in Australia. And out of this egg sac, you know, these tiny, tiny little snails hatch from it. Right, they come out of these little compartments here and they grow into the gigantic snail that I just showed you. But, second. What I want to show you is this particular shelf. This particular shelf is snails. Oh, snails, you know, there's many thousands of different types of snails. There's about actually 200,000, right? 200,000 types of mollusks. And they're grouped into different families. And the families that they're grouped into is based on the shape of the shell, right? So, for example, these are the cone snails because they're all in the cone snail family, right? They're all shaped like cones, like ice cream cones. Right? And then we have the cowrie snails, right? The cowrie snails are also all shaped like this. On this shelf here, all these snails are a similar shape, and they're all called the Murex family. All right, so if I show you some Murexes here. Here we have, two different snails. But you can see that even though they're different colors, different textures, but they're still basically the same overall kind of shape. So they're both in the Murex family. And Murex snails are often extremely, extremely ornate. All right, you see all the textures here, all the... fronds and so on coming off it. By the way, one thing I found at the museum that not everybody realizes that every single seashell was originally an animal. It's interesting. There seems to be a lot of confusion about this. You know, I've met people who think that snails get shells from somewhere else and then they can leave the shells. And that's confusion with hermit crabs. Hermit crabs, got one at the museum. A hermit crab is something that does not have its own shell and therefore it uses an abandoned snail shell as its house. Every single seashell, right, comes from a creature, right? It's the outer casing, the outer skeleton of the creature. Okay, now I'll show you some other Murexes. Oh, this is amazing. This is called a Venus comb Murex. Right? Venus comb Murex, absolutely exquisite. It has all these long spines coming out of it. And nobody knows exactly why. There's all kinds of theories. Maybe it's for defense. Maybe it's something, maybe it stops them sinking into the soft sand. Nobody's exactly sure why just specifically this type of snail has these magnificent spines. It looks like a skeleton, but it's not. You know, this is the shell of the creature.
And then we have,
call it a deer's antler murex. I think it's pretty clear why it's called a deer's antler murex.
We have a rose branch murex.
Check that out. Rose branch murex has these little like flowers growing out of it.
Very, very beautiful. But the murex that we want to concentrate in particular on is not any one of these. It's one that we have in a different room.
So let's move on to a different hall where we're going to look at what our tailet snail actually is. Okay, we've got a little distance to travel here, so bear with me. But you will get more exhibit halls on the way. All right, so now we're traveling through our auditorium. The camel over there. That creature on the wall behind me once had a. Sometimes we have kids who ask if it's a flying squirrel. No, it is not. I go through our hall of biblical wildlife. And now we are entering our hall of shofars. So, Hall of Shofars. Now, a Hall of Shofars, it's not just a Hall of Shofars. Introduction, its full name is the Hall of Shofars and Other Treasures from the Natural World. In other words, in this hall, we have an example of how nature can produce some amazing treasures, things of great beauty, of great value, and which are therefore have a use in the Torah. They're used for mitzvot, right? So, for example, shofars, right? Shofars are beautiful, you know, musical instruments that come from nature, and they're used for a mitzvah. Minerals. We have exhibit cases of minerals here, and which were used for the choshen of the Kohen Gadol for other uses. Right? And the other example is techelet. Right? Techelet, the precious dye, used in the garments of the Kohen, which comes from an animal. Once again, I just see that at the end of the day here, the time switch has switched off the light in the techelet exhibit. So give me a second. I just need to change the timer. Okie dokie. So, behind me is our tailet exhibit. Hold on, tailet is much lower down, so I'm going to have to tilt the camera. All right, here is our tailet aquarium. Now, it's funny, you know, when we ask visitors, you know, what are we exhibiting in this aquarium? So, instantly there are people who say, Nemo, Dory, right? We have clownfish and well, they're all hiding right now. They've got a shock. I turned the light on suddenly. All right, but the fish are just for decoration. We also have some really cool shrimps. Those are just for decoration. Likewise, the corals. What we're exhibiting here is the tailet snail. Right. Okay. And we've got a bunch of snails in here. Some are dead. Some are alive. Let me fish you through this. Here is a tailet snail that you might find now if you go diving or whatever, you're looking at the beach, you might find one of this. And this is the species of murex that we're going to show is actually the tailet. It's called Murex trunculus. Actually, it was renamed recently to Hexaplex trunculus, so I'm going to use those terms interchangeably. This one has already been, it's been bleached, it's been dried out, and it's dead, right? So there's no, it's just an empty shell. But inside the aquarium, let's see what we can find. Oh, this one's also dead. It's an empty shell. Hold on. Aha. Here we go. Here we have a live tailet snail. And how do I know it's alive? It's very simple. There he is. You see that? That's his body inside his shell.
Okay, put him back in. I'll put him over here. So if he wakes up and starts moving, we'll be able to see that happen.
But actually, I did get a picture. Oopsie. Sorry, camera fell over. I did get a picture when one day when they were moving around. There we go.
There you see the body of the snail there, and you see the little antenna where they are sticking out at the bottom. All right, that's a snail on the move.
Okay, well, zoom out. Okay.
In position of the camera.
Okay, so the question is, you know, how do we know? How do we know that this is a snail that Chazal were talking about? So let's return to the clues. So first of all, you know, we know it's a snail, right? It's a chilazon. That's a creature that lives both on land and in the sea. And then land, it comes out after the rain. So we already know it's a snail. Now, let's go over the particular clues the Gemara gives. Now, what I'm going to show is I'm not going to prove to you that the clues perfectly match this snail. All right. What I'm going to do is show that they can match this snail. All right. And then I'm going to show that it can't be talking about anything else. So the first thing is that it says it resembles the sea. All right. It's gufo dome liyam. Its body resembles the sea. Now, so what does that mean exactly? What I would say it means, and I've been snorkeling for these snails in Israel, right? Chof Dor, which is near Zichron Yaakov. Right, and that's, you know, the territory of Gad, the territory where they were historically found. And if you go snorkeling, you can see them. But they're really hard to find because, again, we keep our aquarium very clean, right? But in the wild, things are not so clean, right? Things are covered in algae and all kinds of things. And here, let me clarify. Yeah, so whereas, you know, a dried Murex snail shell looks like this, but in the ocean, it's more like this. It's got algae, all kinds of things, you know, growing on it. Right, and that's not just because that's a dead one. I'll show you in the photo of our live one. Right, also we have, here we go. Also in the live one, it's got all kinds of stuff growing on it. And when it's not moving, it just blends into the seafloor. Right, so that would be how its body is similar to the sea. Now, again, you could argue, some people say, well, does that really mean, is that how you describe body being similar to the sea? Maybe it's something that, I don't know, should look like waves, whatever. But, you know, I'll show you why it has to be the snail. And now I'm saying, yes, you could certainly say that matches. You could certainly explain this idea that it's similar to the sea. Then it talks about how its briato is similar to a fish. Its formation is similar to a fish. Now, what would that mean? Its formation is similar to a fish. Well, some people say, well, that must mean it's a kind of fish. Right? But again, it's not talking about a fish because it's something that lives in the hills also. Right? So obviously not a fish. So what would it mean that it's similar to a fish? It would mean that it's a sea creature, right? It's an animal, right? It's not a coral. It's not something like that. It's not a seaweed, right? It's something that grows like a fish. How do fish grow? They lay eggs, right? And this is what Murexes do. They lay eggs. Our snails actually have been very busy laying eggs. I'm not sure if I can move the camera around to show you the eggs. Ooh. There we go. There's a whole batch of eggs down here. Let me see if I can get them on the camera. See that? See that cluster there? That is a cluster of trailer eggs. All right, and we saw the snails laying them. They basically they get all excited. All the snails come over. The females start laying the eggs. The males start fertilizing them. All right, and that's what it means. How its formation is like a fish, right? That it's a living creature. It grows from eggs. All right, now, next clue.
Hold on.
It talks about how the tchelet comes from its blood. All right, so what's going on here exactly? So it's not the blood. All right, if you smash open the snail, right, there's nothing blue that comes out of it. What it does have, though, is a gland. It has a gland that produces a certain liquid, and scientists are not exactly sure what the function of this liquid is. But when it's chemically processed, it turns into this amazing blue dye.
Oh my God, I went to Jeffrey Spargel.
Sorry, if everyone else could just mute. I'm not sure how to do mute all. But if everyone could just mute their microphone so it doesn't interrupt. Thanks. All right, so what you get is this beautiful blue. Beautiful blue dye. Okay. Now, but it's not its blood. So the answer is, you know, again, we don't see that dam does not necessarily need to refer to blood. Right? Dam could refer to other bodily fluids. Just because we translate dam as blood and general refers to blood, that doesn't mean it has to refer to blood. Right? Maybe it means some other kind of fluids. So certainly, since there is a liquid secretion that comes out of this animal, it's perfectly reasonable to say that that is described as being the blood of the animal. Then the Gemara says that it comes out of the sea once every 70 years. So people say, well, we haven't seen that with murexes, that every 70 years they come out of the sea. But again,
I never went to her in 2018.
Sorry, can we just, I don't know how to do mute all. Can I mute everyone else?
I went to her in 2018.
Sorry, someone's microphone is interfering.
Yeah, you know, your sound is on.
Someone's microphone is interfering. Someone's sound is on. Please, could they mute? You. All right. So again, it doesn't need to, people often interpret the Gemara much more precisely and literally than the Gemara ever meant. Right, this is not like talking about Halley's comet that it comes every 76 years. It means it's something that's very rarely found. Right, it's rarely found. Murexes are often found in deeper ocean waters. It's not so necessarily easy to find them in shallower ocean waters. Right. So so that's what it means every 70 years. And it talks about it being very expensive.
Well, maybe I don't need it every 2 years.
Sorry. The Methodist says his microphone is on, but please can you turn it off? Please can you mute your microphone?
Turn your microphone off now.
Oh, there we go. 1 second. I'll see a way of how to do it. No, I don't.
Wait
a minute.
It's every 2 years.
Oh, I'm not an administrator, so I can't do it. I think it's
It's Hedda Silverstein. Her microphone
Silverstein.
Is on.
Sorry to bother you. Please, can you unmute your microphone?
I don't know how to turn it off.
So keep very, very quiet.
Push mute.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got it.
Thank you very much. Thank you. All right. So Igmas is being very expensive, and it is very expensive. Then we also have another Gemara, and again, there's different ways of interpreting it and so on, but certainly there's a Gemara which, according to many ways of interpreting it, says that the prohibition of trapping a creature on Shabbat does not apply to the chilazon. Now, what would be different about a chilazon that there's no prohibition of trapping it on Shabbat? Every other animal has a prohibition of trapping it on Shabbat. Well, so one obvious difference is that a chilazon, they move very slowly, or not that slowly, because the one I put there is already gone. You were supposed to be watching him for me. Where'd he go? Oh, the camera's not on. Where'd he go? Okay. They didn't move that slowly because the one I put on the rock has already vanished. But they move slowly enough that it doesn't require any particular skill. It's not like you have to chase after them. It's not like catching a lizard, right? You see it and you can just pick it up. All right. And now we also know, the Gemara says, that the Gemara speaks about one of the prohibitions in Shabbat being tying knots. And again, all the things that the activities that are prohibited in Shabbat are the ones that we use to make the Mishkan or to make things for the Mishkan. The Gemara explains, how was tying knots done to prepare things for the Mishkan? And it says that they were tying knots to make nets in order to catch the chilazon. So it's something that you can catch, if you catch in a net. All right, so what do you catch in a net? What do you catch in a net? But simultaneously, it's very easy. Such that, if you were to pick one up on Shabbat, you've not transgressed trapping, so that would be a snail. How do you catch snails? So, I forgot to mention. We think of snails as being these, like, cute creatures. These are voracious. Some snails are, right? Those snails just eat, plant matter. These guys are carnivores, and they are absolutely voracious, right? We had a fish in here that was sickening and dying, and the tailed snails were all over it, right? They just gobbled it up. And the way you'd catch them is you'd put a net in the ocean with some bait in it, some dead flesh, and then you wait a bit, and then you pull it up, and it's covered with chelet snails. And because their shells are kind of, jagged edge, they get caught up in the net. All right. So, and I should mention another thing that the Gemara says, that it's very difficult to distinguish chelet from indigo, from color elan, right? A certain plant-based dye. The Gemara says, it's extraordinarily difficult. God is able to distinguish the two, but otherwise it's very difficult. The Gemara describes a certain test that you can maybe do. And again, the dye that comes from this tailet is chemically the same as the color elan, as the indigo, which would be another indication that it's the same thing. All right, so we've mentioned the various clues in the Gemara. And we've shown how they can, you know, apply to the snip. But there's still people who say, well, maybe they don't apply so well. Maybe it's some other creature. You know, you're saying it's similar to the sea. Well, is it really similar to the sea? Is that really what the clues mean? We don't know for sure. How do you know this is really Tehillet? Maybe it's something else that we just haven't identified yet. Right? There's things that are lost in history. Orot Tachashim. The Mishkan was covered in Orot Tachashim. What is a Tachash? We just don't know. We honestly don't know. I've got some suggestions to discuss it in my book, Sacred Monsters. But the bottom line is we have no idea. So maybe this is the same here. It's something that we just don't know. It's some unknown creature that's still out there. Now, I'm going to explain to you how we know that that is not true, how we can be absolutely confident that this is the creature being discussed. And the argument goes as follows. We know that these snails, right, the Murex trunculus, we know that there was an ancient industry of producing dye from them. This was a famous thing. This wasn't just in Judaism. Right? This was the famous industry in the Mediterranean. Producing dye from Murex trunculus snails. The Phoenicians, right? The Phoenicians were absolutely famous for it. Produced Tyrian purple. Right? It all came from Murex snails. We found archaeological remains on the coast of Israel. You find these factories where they used to produce them, and you find mounds of thousands of these shells. You know, each of them, you know, broken in the place that you need to break them in order to remove the gland to produce the dye. So it's very, very clear that this snail was widely used in antiquity to produce a blue dye. Okay. Now, the second thing that's very clear, I'm not saying that, therefore, it's necessarily Tehillet, but we know that this was the snail that people used to produce a blue dye. Now, the other thing we know is that Chazal, the sages of the Talmud, they were very, very keen to tell us what Tehillet is. Right? They told us various clues that it's similar to the sea and it grows like a fish and so on. And it's very expensive. So they wanted to tell us about it, about what it is. And they also really wanted to make sure that we wouldn't use the wrong thing. Right? You know, the Gemara says, you know, why is the phrase, Ani Hashem Elokeichem, Asher Tzeiti Etchem Eretz Mitzrayim? You know, why is that phrase said regarding the mitzvah of tzitzit? You know, this powerful phrase that I am God who brought you out of Egypt and put tchela in your tzitzit. You know, what's the connection? So the Gemara says it's saying that I am God, right? The almighty God, Lord of the universe, Lord of creation. And I know if you're going to be trying to use the wrong thing. Right? Don't think you're going to catch me out. You don't think you can use some inferior substitute. I know if you're using tchela or not. Right? And of course, halachically, you know, you have to use tchela. So Chazal, they wanted us to know what Tehillet is, and they wanted us, not to use the wrong thing. So put those two things together, and you see why it has to be this. Because since we know that people in the Mediterranean, in this country, in this area, were producing this dye from this snail, so there's no way that if it wasn't this snail, that Chazal wouldn't have made sure not to correct us. Right? If it wasn't this, Chazal would have said, and this, you know, the blue dye that everyone's using, it's not from the snail, it's not from the source that absolutely everybody else is using to make the blue dye, it's from something else. There's no way they wouldn't have said that. Right? They gave us these clues that certainly can apply to this snail. Right? They definitely didn't want us to use the wrong thing. So given that this is the snail that everybody was using for the dye, that must be that that's what Chazal were talking about.
Isn't usually that the Tehillet always comes with the Argaman and Tolat Shani?
Yes. And there's Argaman, the question, the purple dye, was it a different shade? Was it a slightly different species of snail? Was it maybe different snails that you mixed together in different portions? Now, like I said, there is a bit of fuzziness in the details. Now, I don't want to get intricately involved in the details, but the main thing here is that it's clearly a Murex snail, that you can't posit that it's some kind of unknown creature, because Chazal, the sages, they really wanted us to use the right thing and not the wrong thing. And this is a thing that everybody was using and that they certainly didn't try to rule out. So that's how we know it is this snail. I should mention, by the way, I think this is pretty widely known that there are a bunch of people the last few decades who are very much involved in reviving, the use of the snail, Joel Guberman, Baruch Sturman, Ari Zivotofsky, and so on. And they worked out, other names I'm forgetting, but I'm just terrible with names. You know, I never forget a name of a lizard, but with people, I'm not so good. So if I missed out some names of the legendary Tehillet discoverers, I apologize. Amois Navon, that's another one. Right. And what they worked out is how to produce this dye, and you can buy Tehillah today. Now, let's talk about the practical aspects. So, given that we know that this is the Tehillah, what about the practical aspects of wearing it today? So, there's a few things to clarify. Firstly, it's illegal in Israel to take any animal out of the wild. Right? There are some very few exceptions, things that are pests that you can get a special license for and so on. But in general, it is illegal to remove an animal from the wild, right, for very good reasons. Right? So you can't go to Chof Dor and start hunting down some wild Tehillah snails. So when Tehillah is produced today, it's taken from Croatia, from other countries, right, which don't have those laws. And the snails do not appear to be particularly endangered. Lots of snails in the ocean. And that's how it's produced. It is produced by killing the snails. No, you have to smash the snail. And some people feel a bit uncomfortable with that. I visited a lab in Israel, operated, it's not in Haifa University, but it's operated by Haifa University. And I met a fascinating gentleman who has a big warehouse in which he has a breeding program going for these snails. And he's worked out how to make them breed in captivity, which is quite complicated. Oh, I know. Yeah, we have an aquarium full of eggs here, but they don't hatch. We've never managed to get the eggs to hatch. They never hatch. But he's figured out how to raise them in such a way that they actually hatch. And they're cannibalistic, remember, carnivorous and cannibalistic. So it's quite complicated to raise them in such a way they're not going to be eating each other. But he's figured out how to do it. And what he also told me is that he's figured out how to milk them. How to get the liquid that's used to make the dye out of them without actually killing them. I said, well, how do you do it? He said, he wouldn't tell me. Trade secret. He's still working on it. All right. But the bottom line that Tehillah is available today, right? And it's not sourced from Israel. Maybe at one point it will be. Now, I personally do not wear Tehillah. I don't. Which is shocking to some people because, am I not absolutely convinced that Tehillah is the Murex trunculus? And I am. So I have my own personal reasons for not wearing it. It has to do basically with the fact that, as you might know, I'm considered to be a little teeny, teeny bit controversial. Right? This is going back to my books in Science and Torah that were banned 18 years ago. But even until this day, I'm regarded as being slightly controversial. I just heard a whole podcast the other day by two rabbis discussing the phenomenon of Slifkinism. And what it has to do with certain, beliefs, ideas that I teach about, conceptual ideas related to Torah and science and so on. So because I'm considered to be quite radical out there, I want to stress that when it comes to actual practical halacha, I do believe in being very, very conservative with a lowercase c, right? And it's something I teach about in the context of spontaneous generation, where the Gemara teaches certain laws based on spontaneous generation or the belief in that. And now we know there's no such thing as spontaneous generation. Does the halacha change? Rav Herzog says, no, it doesn't, because the halacha has been canonized, which is something I very much support. Right? It might be shocking, but I'm a very strong believer in tradition. Judaism is as Judaism does. And the fact is that Tehillah is something which is was lost from history, and it's not generally done. And reviving it, it's very nice, but I personally think that it's not necessarily, how can I say this in the right way? Don't want to get into trouble. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that it hasn't been universally accepted. Because to be honest, right now, there are not enough snails. I mean, maybe there's enough snails in the ocean. I don't know. Certainly in terms of harvesting them, to produce enough Tehillah, if every Jew decided to wear Tehillah, I do not believe that there's remotely enough snails for that. Not even remotely. It takes an enormous amount of snails to produce the dye. And I think that, if Jews were suddenly to be causing, the near extermination of a historically very significant, ecologically significant species of snail, I don't think that would be a great thing. All right. So maybe, one day when it's more accepted halachically, it's considered to be normative. It's not considered to be, changing the practice of Am Yisrael in light of scientific discovery. And there's also ways to farm them to make it widely available without having to raid the oceans. All right. So then, I'll join the team. But, right now, again, personally, as someone who's considered to be very radical theologically, I don't want to be seen as being radical halachically. Certainly room to argue with that approach. That is my personal approach. The other interesting thing, question to consider is that Yes, we know that Tchelet was historically produced from this snail. But does that mean that it has to be? That's something that's not, it's not very clear to me. You know, the Torah speaks about Tchelet. Chazal speak about how authentic Tchelet was derived. But does that mean it has to be derived that way? What if you can get a different type of Murex snail? Right? There's many types of Murex snails around the world that produce the same dye. And some of them can be milked. Some of them don't have to be killed. You can just milk them. Right? It's done in, I believe, in South America. Right? So what does the Torah mean? Does it have to be the snail that was used in the Mediterranean? Could it be a different type of snail? Could it be something else that's just, you know, chemically identical? On the other hand, the Gemara did not want Kala Ilan, which is chemically identical. But maybe it didn't want that because something to do with how it was prepared in antiquity that made it you know, less special, less significant, less important. Or maybe the idea that it has to be the snail because this snail is so special and is so rare and is so expensive. Maybe that's part of it. All right, so there's a lot of speculation you could do on what exactly is the significance of this snail in particular, right? And does it have to be that snail? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Do we wear it today or do we not? Those are all kinds of interesting questions to explore. People will have different answers. You know, ask your personal halakhic authority if you're not able to reach a decision yourself. All right, but one thing that is clear is that historically, this is the snail that was used for Tchelet. All right. I hope you enjoyed that voyage of marine discovery. Any questions? Also, the Ptil Tchelet, the organization, they have a website with a huge archive of resources on this if you'd like to learn more about it.
There are questions on the chat, Rob Slifkin.
Oh, there are? Okay, hold on. Oh, I actually have to scroll down. Here we go. Okay. Someone said, why didn't Chazal say directly that this was a snail? Well, they did. You know, they did. They said, it's the chilazon, right? It's the chilazon. It's the one that, you know, looks like the ocean and its dye that comes from it is very expensive. You know, they're talking about it as a known thing. Right? Someone said that it turns, it's one of the specifications that it turns blue when exposed to the sun. It's not a specification. That's just, you know, the procedure. You know, Rav Herzog, right? First chief rabbi of Israel. He was the one who originally figured that all the clues pointed to the murex, but he couldn't figure out how to produce a blue dye from it. It was only much later that it was discovered how you actually produce the dye from it, and it involves exposing it to the sun. I really want to show you one of our snails on the move, so maybe I'll put him back on the rock, and we can remember to take a look at him in a few seconds. Come here, Mr. Snail. There we go. All right, we'll try and keep an eye on him. Somebody wrote, could this be a case of people at the time assuming something was so obvious it didn't have to be fully spelled out? Absolutely. Yep, you've nailed it. That's it. In other words, this was a snail. This is where blue came from. Right, so they don't have to, they have to warn against using fakes, right? Blue that comes from color elan, from a plant or something, you know, but they're talking about the animal, right? They didn't. They just had to, you know, talk about it in broad terms. Exactly. It was so obvious what it was, and that's the proof. Right? If it wouldn't have been that, they would have had to spell it out. Right? If it wouldn't have been the Murex snail, they would have had to spell it out and say, and it's not the thing that also lives in the ocean and that everybody else is using to produce this rare, expensive blue dye.
Is he on the move yet? Nope.
I will mention that I think next week I have a schedule conflict and we're going to be missing next week's class and we'll have to take a break until the following week. Again, if you want to learn more about this topic, obviously you can come visit our exhibit in the museum. I also recommend subscribing to our museum newsletter and you can learn more about the museum on our website, biblicalnaturalhistory.org. Again, biblicalnaturalhistory.org.
I have a question about the yes. snail life cycle. So that they're yes. very tiny when they hatch. Do they crawl out of their shells and then grow a new one?
No. The shell stays with them the whole life. The shells grow bigger. Again, it's hermit crabs. Hermit crabs are the only things that change shells because they do not have a particularly hard carapace and they borrow snail shells. And as they grow, they keep needing to go out of the snail shell and find a bigger one. But snails, the shell is part of them, right? It's their body, it's their exoskeleton, and it grows with them their entire life.
Aren't there other animals that shed their exoskeleton and grow a new one, though?
Oh, yes. Correct. Crab? Yeah, in that sense, a crab, say not a hermit crab, right? Say a regular crab. or insects. Tarantulas, that's a great example. Now we have tarantulas in the museum. And how do they grow? Insects have an external skeleton. So every couple of weeks or months, the tarantula will like go into this little huddle and it will split open, right? And the tarantula, the spider, will come out of its old skin and you're left with like a replica tarantula, which is just the skin. And the new tarantula, it gradually, you know, its new skin is soft at the beginning and it swells. It swells up so it can grow and then it hardens. And then it can't grow again until the next time that it sheds. Right, correct. That is how happens with insects. Snakes too, right? Our snakes are, you know, they shed their skin in one piece as they grow.
Oh my gosh, she's gone again.
That's the skin. Are you available for a question?
Yeah.
Okay, so I asked whether or not all snails reproduce the way the Murex snail reproduces with the egg laying, or are there other ways that they...
No, that's how they all do it, as far as I know. All the 200,000 or so species of snails, that's how they reproduce.
Even the ones that we see in our gardens.
I have to help out my poor snail here. What he did was he moved a little bit and then he fell off the rock. Now he's face down. So let me just... so we're not gonna see much action. I'll show you why. Look. Yeah, I put him down here because he fell off the rock. What he's gonna do, he's not gonna go roaming around. He's just gonna bury himself deep in the sand. That's what they like to do. You know, they have their seasons when they're very busy, where they're roaming and crawling all around the aquarium. But that's only rare periods. Most of the time, they're just settled in the sand. Unless when it's feeding time, right? If there's something dead in the aquarium or something flesh, then they come. They sense it somehow, they smell it, and they come swarming out to cluster over it. Okay, any more questions? All right, so I think we'll wrap it up there for today. And I look forward to seeing you in our next class.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very welcome.
Thank you. Excellent.
Thank you.